This is a podcast of ABC Radio National's Late Night Live. This program can be heard broadcast or streamed from ABC Radio National. Details of frequencies, times and more downloads, abc.net.au/rn.
To Late Night Live. I'm Norman Swan. Philip Adams is off in Italy for 3 weeks, taking the winter air, and you've got me. Well, not only me, but Late Night Live's usual regulars and conspirators. And on this programme, a conspirator in chief, I suppose you'd call him, former Marine, former UN weapons inspector, registered Republican, and debunker of the CIA and its firmly held belief from Desert Storm onwards that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Scott Ritter has a book out called Iraq Confidential, and we'll be talking to him later. There's also some live music, and being Monday, we go to France, where else, to talk to our British columnist, Bea Campbell. Good evening, Bea.
Hello there.
Now, speaking of Iraq Confidential, I don't know where these publishers get their titles from, but the former British ambassador to Washington has just put out a book called DC Confidential.
Well, he has, and it's this confidential book has ignited a great controversy for two reasons, really. One is that the story he has to tell about the British Prime Minister's relationship with President Bush is, of course, alarming, and it's one of these stories which is set to reignite the burning embers of the whole debate about the Iraq War. He, Christopher Meyer, was a supporter of the war, but he does say that he believes that Prime Minister Blair did have the power to at least put pressure on Bush to delay the beginning of the war, but that Blair was so abject and mesmerised and caught in the celebrity and cachet of his relationship with the Americans and his relationship with power, that he didn't mobilise the kind of power he himself had to restrain the Americans.
Why has he written this book? I mean, it seems extraordinary. It was almost like a breach of loyalty in the British civil service, the British diplomatic
service.
That's
the other side of the debate about Christopher Meyer's whole thing. There's a very powerful feeling, particularly amongst people who themselves have been connected to public service, that he and indeed other envoys, by writing these kinds of memoirs, which include lots of personal details about, you know, what kind of underpants people wore and what their manners were like and whether people were impressed by them. He says, for example, about Jack Straw, the Foreign Secretary, that he was a man more to be liked than admired. There is a feeling there is a feeling that this really does represent a breach of trust, and that if these very senior public servants cannot be trusted to keep their counsel, then the whole transaction between public servants and elected representatives becomes an impossible one. The kind of confidentiality that they'd expect to share.
Can his account be trusted? Can his account be trusted?
Can't be trusted.
You don't think it can?
Well, I think that I feel, you know, that mentality myself, which is partly engrossed in the detail of the text, which I've read, and partly you can't argue with the case that these kinds of memoirs make the trust between politicians and their public servants, which is vital to their relationship, really very precarious.
He thought Bush was quite smart.
Well, he did. I suppose you have to say he's probably right. At some level, there's a kind of cunning, smart, and the man is passionate about his purpose and his mission. And, of course, he is served by the greatest intelligence machinery and public service machinery in the world.
I mean, Blair is no fool. I mean, and to say that he was mesmerised by power is really quite demeaning. I mean, can't Blair be allowed the same passion as Bush?
I think that the Well, you've raised two interesting things there, which are absolutely salient to the ongoing and irascible debates about the war. The first thing is that it is widely said about Blair that he is thrilled by possessing power and being proximate to other people's power, and that it is also, of course, rather salient in these times when Britain's presidency of the European Union is being severely criticised for being adrift. And the reason it's adrift is because Britain doesn't quite know what it's doing and needs to do in Europe. And, of course, he squandered much of the goodwill that he already had in Europe because of his commitment to Bush and the Iraq War. And, of course, because of the steady hemorrhaging of evidence about whether the war was legal and whether it was justified.
Let's go back to Christopher Mayer for a moment. One gets the impression, I've not read the book, but one gets the impression from the reports of the book that he typifies almost a new diplomacy. Once upon a time, ambassadors were there to, you know, quietly go about their business. He sounds almost interventionist in the process. He was a confidant of both sides. He facilitated meetings. He expressed his opinion strongly in meetings.
That's true. And I suppose it reveals something, if not about diplomacy in general, it reveals something about that relationship. That relationship was burdened by the Iraq War project. And everybody, from the intelligence services to the diplomatic services, was enlisted in that cause. And so someone like him, who did indeed believe in the war, although he thought that it should have, that they should have been allowed to have more time to see whether the evidence would be harvested to support the war. Nonetheless, he was, like so many other people we now know, engaged to, if you like, stretch the limits of what their public service protocols were. And I think that the thing that's interesting about that text, whatever one thinks about the ethics of it and the etiquette of it, is that it's being published at a time which is very unsettling for Blair, given the emergence of other stories and other texts about what was actually taking place, both in the way in which the evidence was produced and about the conduct of the war. I'm thinking particularly of the new book by Joseph Wilson IV, the diplomat who...
This is another ambassador.
Yes, the former ambassador who was dispatched to Niger to check out the story that was used both by Bush and by Blair.
This is the uranium yellow cake to Iraq story.
That's right. That Iraq had tried to buy uranium yellow cake from Niger. Now,
so this is his book. Well, he hasn't got a book. He's got an article in the New York Times. Was it Niger Confidential? Or
yes. Well, of course, what he did was to go to Niger in 2002 to report to the State Department that there was nothing to support the evidence that there had been this transaction. Indeed, that the documentation did look fraudulent. And yet, in September 2002, the British were still citing it, despite very challenging investigations by our own investigative MP, Lynn Jones. And then again, it appeared once more in Bush's State of the Union speech. And of course it's now embroiled. This story is at the heart.
Because he went there on the advice of his wife, on the recommendation of his wife, Valerie Plame.
That is the allegation. It's not founded, that allegation, but that's part of the story swirling around the White House as we speak, that he was sent, appointed by his wife,
or recommended
because
by his wife.
The CIA were against the war. He wasn't particularly for or against the war, but what he was someone who was familiar with Africa. And certainly what he was someone who confirmed that this story was fraudulent.
Of course, later on tonight's program, we're talking to Scott Ritter, and in his book, Iraq Confidential, he actually argues that CIA was pro-war and pro-destabilization and not for disarmament.
Exactly.
At all.
Exactly.
So it suggests that, in that sense, Valerie Plame, the outed CIA agent, was rogue within the organisation.
Or an innocent victim in something which was a much larger and weirder kind of setup. Either which way, the truth of the situation is that what Joseph Wilson IV found was already suspected by the Americans' own ambassador in Niger and was confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Commission, which, of course, incidentally, saw the documentation and said this is nonsense, this is a fraud.
But it's almost too easy, isn't it, to say that, going back to Mayer and Blair, you know, that he's just beguiled by power. I mean, you don't commit a nation to war because you're beguiled by power. You don't constantly deny facts that are before you, surely.
Well, you go to war because you want to. And the debate about what the war was for remains unsettled. Certainly it's very, very unsettled in Britain, where one of the arguments that's been aired actually just this last week by a group of families, the relatives of young soldiers who were killed in Iraq, are taking the government to the Royal Courts of Justice on the grounds that they are still unconvinced that the war was legal and that their relatives died in what might have been an illegal war. Their bodies, you see, were taken back to Bryce Norton, which is a military base. Many of these families still haven't had an inquest that would establish publicly the cause of death. So the causes of the war, they really are a spectre haunting Mr. Blair. And Mr. Blair's position is, well, whether there was evidence that Iraq was strong or weak, armed or disarmed, is all irrelevant. I was right to go. And it's become an argument based on a kind of faith that in itself requires some justification, whether, you know, whatever the evidence was.
And you say that his EU presidency is shaky. He's gone in on a plank of saying that he's going to withdraw farm subsidies and change the face of the budget. Are you saying that that's just not going to happen?
It's very doubtful that he can settle the budget question before the end of British presidency. And the notion that Britain would be at the heart of a modernised Europe is now, of course, a fantasy. It's extremely unlikely that the budget issue will be settled, and there are many other issues to be settled, given the enlargement question.
Didn't they just remove some subsidies in the last couple of days? I noticed in the papers. I can't remember which ones.
But each one is accompanied by huge rows, and of course, there are differential interests throughout Europe around the consequences of changing these subsidies. See, what really is at the heart of this argument isn't so much whether Britain has or doesn't have subsidies, whether we have payback or not, whether the French farming system is over-subsidised or not. What really is at the heart of this is, and this is why Blair appointed Peter Mandelson to be the trade commissioner in Europe, is because Britain's place, if you like, in the European project is to drive on with its neoliberal project, its liberalisation of the European economy. And one of the reasons why this is felt to be so challenging is that across the rest of Europe, there is still a commitment to the thing which has characterised Europe in the second half of the 20th century, modern, liberal, expanded welfare states. And the premises of those welfare states is the thing that will be that really is being destabilised by the Blair project in Europe, which is about liberalisation of markets. It's not about the social chapter, welfarist values, which have made Europe the place that it is.
But Mandelson's known as a fixer and politically very astute. Are you saying he's not performing that well in the European context?
Well, he's been a fixer and a very astute magician within his party. Bear in mind, wherever Peter Mandelson has had power or a job to do outside the party, a job in government, it always produced havoc and chaos. It produced havoc in the Department of Trade and Industry, produced havoc in Northern Ireland, where he left unlamented on all sides. And there have been a trail of rows while he's been the Trade Commissioner in Europe. This is a man who's skills as a Machiavellian have been vaunted, but largely within his own party, which, bear in mind, was an abject party when he got it by the throat and made it into an electable party.
So there was only room for improvement. And the rumour is, of course, it's the eternal discussion that this will speed up the transition in terms of the Labour leadership.
Who can tell? One of the things that I constantly feel is rather fascinating about the Labour leadership is that what we don't know anything about is what Gordon Brown, the successor in waiting, thinks about the Iraq war. There is more stuff lurking.
Yeah, these Scots are too canny, you know, just keep your powder dry, B.
Well, on a matter as grave as why we went to war and how we went to war, why, for example, the Ministry of Defence has kept on denying that chemical weapons or incendiary weapons were being used. It took a little old investigative MP, Alice Mann, to dig out a confession from the Ministry of Defence that, in fact, incendiary, horrible, grotesque incendiary weapons and chemical weapons have been used. And we await the revelation of what Gordon Brown thinks about all of this.
Well, it'll give us endless time for discussion. Bea Campbell, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Yet again. Bea Campbell, journalist and commentator, and you're listening to Late Night Live here on ABC Radio National. And coming up, as I said earlier, we've got former weapons inspector Scott Ritter, but before that, some live music. Australian multi-instrumentalist Kim Sanders, who plays everything from, you know, Bulgarian nose flutes to tenor saxophone and percussion, and Peter Kennard, who's with him, who studied drumming in West Africa and performed in Japan with Colin Offord's great Boeing company, and in many different places. They've got a new CD out called Transcend Dancing. They're in our adjacent studio ready to go. Kim Sanders, I assume that you're going to play excerpts from The King and I, is that right?
Yes, that's right, with a bit of an Eskimo reggae feel in the middle. No, we're going to play a bit of Turkish Sufi music, a Saz Semai in Sabah Makam.
Fabulous. Thanks to Kim Sanders and Peter Kennard. I've never heard The King and I played in that way, but it was just fantastic. Their latest CD is Transcendancin', and you can get more information on it from Late Night Live's website. And in fact, it's been launched at Paddington Church Hall, Eastside Music Cafe, if you're living in Sydney or visiting Sydney on December 3rd. And the doors open at 8 o'clock, and we'll give you details on our website. And you're listening to ABC Radio National. I'm Norman Swan. It's hard to think of someone on the international stage who's upset so many people over the last few years. He's really upset the CIA, mightily annoyed three US administrations, got neoconservatives up in arms, and at several points in the 90s, the Iraqis weren't too chuffed with him either. He's former US Marine, card-carrying Republican, and former member of UNSCOM, the UN Special Commission to Disarm Iraq, for whom he was a weapons inspector specialising in ballistic missiles. Between 1991 and 1998, Scott Ritter tried to find Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and came to the conclusion that they'd complied with instruction to destroy them and had none. In 2002, he even went to Iraq to try to avert the war. Now, in his new book, Iraq Confidential, he argues that the United States never really wanted a disarmament. It was regime change almost at any cost. Scott Ritter, welcome to Late Night Live.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me, are you still a registered Republican?
Well, I consider myself an American first and foremost. Political affiliation needs to take second seat to that.
But were you ever a Republican? It's on your advertising card.
I've always been a Republican, registered, and for a long time voted strictly party line until I recognized the need to study the candidate and act accordingly.
Now, your enemies say that you've flip-flopped over the years. You've said one thing at one time, one thing at another. Here you're arguing that, in essence, there was a conspiracy that the Secret Service, the CIA, three administrations, never really wanted disarmament. They just wanted regime change. I suppose, given the history of flip-flopping, why should we believe, although it's a thick book, why should we believe your argument?
Well, let's start with the notion that I was right and everybody else was wrong. So let's put the flip-flop argument to bed right away.
Because Richard Butler is one of the people who, the former ambassador for UNSCOM.
Richard Butler was also somebody who has stated that there would be weapons of mass destruction in Iraq waiting to be found, and he was wrong. So I think it's just far too convenient for people like Richard Butler and others to be dismissive of my stance. Which, by the way, has been consistent and not subjected to any flip-flopping. But it's a way of just distracting people from the fact that I was right and they were wrong.
When you're saying you're right, that you predicted there would be no weapons of mass destruction before the war started.
To be more accurate, I stated that while we could not be certain that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, clearly, the case made by the Bush administration was a case that was not based on fact, but rather rumor and speculation, and that before we go to war, either the Bush administration needed to put the intelligence information that it was basing their charges against Iraq on the table and subject it to full review, or let weapons inspectors return to Iraq and complete the task of disarmament, which has been my stance all along. I resigned in 1998 in protest over America's interference with the work of weapons inspectors. And I said from day one that we need to let the weapons inspectors get back to Iraq and finish the job, that the job was not done. There was work to be done. We're not able to account for the totality of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. And I articulated consistently throughout the time from 1998 up until March 2003 that we need to let the inspectors do their job.
But what were the missing bits? Because when you read the book, you get the impression that you were actually pretty convinced there was almost nothing left, maybe 20 scuds or something like that, you know, really small numbers that you thought that were left. And the real gap that you felt was that they had retained the ability to make weapons of mass destruction. They had documents, they had dual-purpose manufacturing facilities that they could turn over. Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. Look, disarmament, according to the Security Council resolutions that mandated the work of the inspectors, was 100%. And it's not the purview of the inspectors to sit there and say 90% is good enough, 95%. But we had achieved 90 to 95% certainty over the accounting of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
Which, in fact, had been destroyed, you say, before Correct. Any weapons inspections had taken place.
No. Some were destroyed by the war. Some were declared
by
Iraq, Desert Storm 1991. Some were declared by Iraq to the weapons inspectors and subjected to destruction by the inspectors. The vast majority were unilaterally destroyed by Iraq in the summer of 1991 and then declared to the weapons inspectors in March of 1992. So a lot of our work from March 1992 onwards wasn't searching for hidden weapons, but verifying the Iraqi claims that they had destroyed everything in the summer of 1991. And unfortunately, when Iraq lied to us, which they did early on in 1991, we could not take anything they said at face value. We could not give them the benefit of the doubt. We set the standard for verification very high, and Iraq was not able to meet that standard on certain aspects of its program. But I can tell you this. We did not have hard intelligence information that said Iraq retained weapons of mass destruction. We had
You were constantly trying to prove a negative.
That's absolutely correct. And this is the point I continuously try to make. And it's one that I made in June 2000, when I said, look, we have to stop trying to prove the negative. We have to stop, searching for every nut, bolt, and screw. I call that quantitative disarmament, 100% certainty. So it's time that we start looking at Iraq from a qualitative standpoint. And when you do so, it becomes clear, crystal clear, that Iraq was fundamentally disarmed. And I wrote this out in an article that appeared in Arms Control Today in the June 2000 issue. I'm very proud of that because what I wrote in June 2000 turned out to be 100% correct. Richard Butler took exception to it and accused me of changing my position, but I changed nothing.
Now, you almost hero worshipped Ekios, the chairman of UNSCOM, yet you're not quite so praiseworthy of his success, the ambassador, I should say, to UNSCOM, and you're not quite so praiseworthy of Butler. What's your view of Butler?
Well, let's start off with Ekios. I don't know if hero worshipping is quite the right term.
Well, there's nearly a bad word to be said about him in the book.
Well, because he was consistent. I mean, if I were to be critical.
So he was the first ambassador for UNSCOM.
He was the first ambassador. And I think if you read between the lines, you'll see that he played a political game. When I talk about his departure from the special commission, it was, he departed with a job that was not completed. He had not finished his task. And so, and a large reason why he hadn't finished that task is because of the policies of the United States. I mean, Ekios is aware of America's policy of regime change, etc. And yet he consistently navigates these treacherous waters. Richard Butler comes in, and there's nothing consistent about him in terms of attempting to navigate treacherous diplomatic waters towards an objective that's representative of a mandate of disarmament. Richard Butler comes in almost.
Are you saying he wasn't independent? He was in U.S.
politics. He was basically an adjunct of the American foreign policy team. He was not an independent implementer of Security Council mandate. And this is where I'm very critical of Richard.
Well, let's hear some stories that argue your point before we come back to, you know, just sort of testing him a little bit. I mean, one of the early inspections in the early years was Unscombe 24, where you ended up in a sewage works. Thanks to you say CIA intelligence.
Well, I mean, it
just was, tell us the story briefly.
The agency, you know, we had concerns that Iraq had not told the whole story about its ballistic missile program and other weapons. I was focused on missiles. In fact, in November of 1991, I had written an assessment that said that, you know, there were maybe 100 missiles missing. The CIA shows up and gives us this briefing about where things are hidden. And it includes a facility in downtown Baghdad we called the Karama Police Barracks. And in particular, there was an annex to it where we were told there were missiles hidden. And so we do the detailed planning. We swoop in, surround the site, while most of the team is digging through this site, which was a police barracks, no weapons of mass destruction. I lead a sub-team to the annex, and it turned out to be a sewage processing plant. But true to our nature as intrusive inspectors,
you left no turd unturned.
We left nothing unturned, and we delved into the depths. We probed the cisterns, and we determined that the only weapon to mass destruction was biological material of a human nature.
So where did they get that intelligence from? Did they ever come clean on that? Where were they getting it from?
By this time, the CIA had exhausted what we would call the grade A intelligence. And they
That's
were
now, people on the ground telling them what
well,
was
just
going on.
Accurate stuff, good defectors, people coming out, sound assessment based upon multiple sources. And now what they're relying on are what we call the single-source defectors who come out, and there's no way to corroborate what they're saying as being accurate. And normally what happens is that this intelligence is not considered actionable. You don't act on it. You don't risk people's lives because inspections were an inherently dangerous job.
Did anybody lose their life in an inspection?
Thank goodness during the time of weapons inspectors from 1991 to 1998, not a single UN weapons inspector was seriously injured or killed in Iraq. You can't say that about the inspections that took place in 2002 and onwards. There were lives lost, but while we were there, no one got hurt.
And you describe sometimes sitting for days outside a facility waiting to get in while the politics played out.
Well, this happened frequently, especially when we got to facilities that the Iraqis considered to be sensitive to their national security and having nothing to do, from their standpoint, with disarmament. Presidential security facilities, presidential palaces, ministries, etc. But, you know, to the detriment of the Iraqi position, in the summer of 1992, as a case in point, we surrounded a facility called the Agricultural Ministry.
This was Unscombe 40.
Unscombe 40. And we believe that there was an archive of material, documents, in this building. The Iraqis said that there wasn't, and they didn't let us in. They harassed the team.
And this was information, if I remember rightly, from a defector. So this was good quality information.
Well, this was information provided by the British government based upon a defector report, which they had corroborated with at least three other sources. So it was
good.
So
you thought this was hot?
It was hot, and it turned out to be 100% correct.
But there was nothing there when you got there.
Well, because we were compelled to leave the site because of threats to the lives of the inspectors. There were demonstrations taking place that, you know, pelted the inspectors with vegetables and such, which isn't inherently dangerous, but it led to an escalation of interaction that resulted in having somebody try to stab an inspector with a skewer. And once an inspector's life is put at risk, you know, we determined from day one that, you know, we're not special forces, we're not the SAS, we're not, you know, there to die for our country. And if the situation becomes such that lives are put at risk, that we withdraw. And so the team was withdrawn. And what we found out later is during that interim period between the withdrawal of the initial team and the return of inspectors, that the Iraqis evacuated the archive so that once inspectors gained access to the site, they found nothing.
And that was the archive that turned up in the nephew's or the son-in-law's chicken farm when
That's
he
correct.
Defected to Jordan.
In August of 1995, we finally gained access to the archive because the defection of Hussein Kamal created conditions in Iraq that suddenly made it uncomfortable for the Iraqi government to hold on to these documents, and so they did turn them over.
Now, you all, one of the themes that are going through this, it's a fascinating story of different secret services. So you've got the CIA on one hand, whom you describe almost universally as incompetent, and you describe the Iraqi Secret Service as actually wanting to, it's almost breathtaking at one point in the book, you describe them and you argue that they actually wanted to comply with the inspections,
right,
against their own government.
Well, it's not comply with the inspections against their government in terms of retaining weapons of mass destruction. On the surface, a lot of people say, my goodness, where's this guy coming from? Except let's refer to the CIA's own report, the Iraq Survey Group, that states unequivocally that Iraq had destroyed all of its weapons of mass destruction in 1991. Now, we didn't know that as weapons inspectors, so we were operating under the premise that these weapons still existed. But keeping in mind the CIA's assessment today, it's not strange, therefore, when one says that the Iraqi Mukhabarat's job was to try and find out,
the
Secret Service, was to find out why the inspectors would not believe the Iraqis. There was something going on in their mind. They said, look, we've destroyed the weapons. Why aren't they believing us? What is it about what we're doing that's making this unbelievable? Because their job wasn't necessarily to help us disarm Iraq, but rather create the conditions for the lifting of economic sanctions. Economic sanctions
are
starving
Iraq. So they saw
the country
being damaged. And
well, their job is national security, and the greatest threat to the security of Iraq at that time were sanctions.
You're listening to Late Night Live here on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and via your MP3 player with me, Norman Swan. And I'm talking to Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector in Iraq for UNSCOM. But, to be fair to the CIA, the Iraqi Secret Service must have been pretty frustrated with Tariq Aziz and the Iraqi hierarchy, who were not being very compliant and giving stuff up. They were their own worst enemies. Why, if your argument is correct, and the best interest of Iraq was to come clean, wasn't the senior hierarchy of Iraq coming clean?
Well,
for example, these documents you're talking about, they contained information about the manufacturer and about dual-purpose manufacturing facilities and so on.
Well, it's not as easy to say that Iraq was disarmed in 1991. You actually have to look at three stages of disarmament. First come the weapons, which they claimed and history has shown that they destroyed unilaterally in 1991. But they still retained production capability that had not been completely turned over. By 1993, though, Iraq was turned over to monitoring inspections that covered the totality of their industrial infrastructure, and Iraq had to finally give up the last bits and pieces of capabilities that could be used, converted to weapons of mass destruction. But they still held on to the documents, the brain trust, so that eventually once sanctions are lifted, they could use these documents to reconstitute with new equipment. They gave that up in 95. Now, one would think that that's the end of the story. The problem comes not with these capabilities, but the mechanisms that were used by Iraq from 1991 to 1995 to hide these capabilities from the inspectors. And these mechanisms were actually the security apparatus, the security service of Saddam Hussein, his personal bodyguards, the people responsible for presidential security. As inspectors, we had a responsibility not only to find the weapons, but to make sure that they weren't hiding additional capabilities, additional weapons, unaccounted for weapons. And it's not just about the weapons, but the mechanisms of concealment, this what we call the concealment mechanism, which means we had to investigate how they hid weapons from us from 91 to 95, who did this, how they did it, and to make sure they weren't continuing to do this. This meant we had to investigate the security of Saddam Hussein. And this is where the Iraqis drew the line. They said, we'll give up the weapons, we'll give up the capabilities, but we're not going to allow you to get near the security of the president. So they lied to us. They lied to us about what occurred in 1991. They lied to us about what occurred from 92 to 95. As we uncovered these lies, it made us suspicious of their motivation. Why are they lying? Are they lying to hide weapons of mass destruction, which is what many of the inspectors, including myself, believed? Or are they lying for another reason? And what we now know is they were lying for another reason, because they were concerned about American efforts to target their president. And they were concerned about American efforts to infiltrate the inspectors, to use the inspection as a vehicle to spy on Saddam. So they viewed inspections as a threat to their national security. And this is why they continuously blocked our weapons inspections.
Did you ever get beyond that line? Did it ever breach that security cordon around the president?
Oh, we did. I mean, we actually were very successful at gaining access to people, to organizations, to communications. One of the programs that I ran in Iraq was a communications intercept program that basically listened in on the conversations of Saddam's security services to find out not about Saddam, but to see that if they were in fact talking about hiding weapons while inspections were going on.
This was an elaborate scheme to actually flush them out while you were having a very aggressive inspection scheme.
Correct.
And you, because this is the third corner of the triangle when you were talking about Secret Services here is the Israeli Secret Service, and you got heavily involved with them, and you're full of praise for the Israeli Secret Service and the quality of their information.
Right. You know, I'm not here to praise the Likud Party or the Israeli government or any of their policies with the Palestinians. I'm only here to talk about my role as a weapons inspector. And the Israelis provided us with outstanding intelligence information that was uniformly accurate, very detailed. And the beauty of it was not only what it allowed us to accomplish in Iraq in terms of tying up loose ends regarding Iraq's programs, but also that it co-opted the Israelis. Because with the Israelis committing aggressively to the success of inspections, if we found Iraq to be disarmed, the Israelis could not question that outcome. They could not say, well, wait a minute, you haven't inspected here, you haven't inspected here. We worked with the Israelis closely to make sure that we exhausted the totality of their intelligence information about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
And you describe intercepting missile parts in Amman as
one
point.
Again, they were very, very helpful to us. But the other interesting thing is that they helped us not only intercept missile parts in Amman, but they helped us with this signals intelligence operation that gave them access to information that could enable them to target Saddam. And the Israelis treated the relationship with the inspectors with a respect that was lacking in Washington, D.C.
And this is, if you like, the core of your argument that they weren't interested in disarmament, and the assumption is that it was regime destabilization and regime change that three successive administrations wanted. Because when you presented information to the CIA or the U.S. or the State Department, they didn't believe it.
Well, it's not that they didn't believe it. They just wouldn't accept it. They would say they didn't believe it, but the fact of the matter is, when we present fact, they come back with rhetoric. So it's hard for me to accept the notion of them saying we don't believe it, because to say we don't believe it, they have to demonstrate the basis of their belief. And ultimately, the basis of their belief was an unwillingness to accept anything that came from the inspection process.
And are you as confident about biological weapons as you are about ballistic missiles?
Well,
not your area.
No, biological weapons isn't my area. It's the area of
but still weapons of mass destruction.
Absolutely. But there are certain things about biological weapons that remove the necessity of me being a biological weapons expert, such as the fact that biological weapons have a shelf life. And once you destroy the manufacturing process in Iraq, even if they hid biological capability, biological weapons, biological agent, after a certain period of time, it becomes useless goop. So it's irrelevant whether or not I know how to build a biological agent. What I know is that the factory was dismantled, destroyed, eliminated, and
Average brewery could actually manufacture.
That's just simply not true. You will not find a serious expert on biological agent that'll tell you you can manufacture weapons-grade anthrax in a brewery. You can't do it.
The other thing that just, you have to question this motivation. Your argument is three successive administrations. I mean, you take George H.W. Bush, the father. Let's just take that administration for the moment. Okay, there was bad feeling after Desert Storm, wishing that they'd gone into Iraq and completed the task. Yet there was a long piece in The New Yorker about a month ago, an interview with Brent Scowcroft, National Security Advisor under Bush, first Bush, who argues that he's not an interventionist, he's very opposed to the Iraq war, he's fallen out with Bush the younger, and believes that you should actually stand back from regimes and are not committed to regime change. You know, if you believe him and what he says now, he's not necessarily somebody who would have pushed terribly hard for regime change. He would have been happy, not necessarily happy, but prepared to leave Iraq the way it was rather than commit U.S. troops to another war.
I would just ask Brent Scowcroft to address two issues. One, the statement made by his president, the commander-in-chief, in the summer of 1991 that basically said, even if Iraq complies with its obligation to disarm, economic sanctions will not be lifted until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. Now, Bernd Scowcroft might say that, look, we want to box Saddam Hussein in with economic sanctions, and we're going to stand back. But it's still a policy of regime change that manifested itself in October 1992 with a lethal finding, a covert action by the president authorizing the CIA to use whatever means necessary up to and including the use of lethal force to remove Saddam Hussein from power. And Brent Scowcroft was a drafter of this finding. So, you know, Scowcroft can try and do revisionist history today and separate himself from this policy. But the facts remain the facts. And Brent Scowcroft is at the genesis of a decade-long policy of regime change that defined three successive presidential administrations.
And the Clinton administration, you resigned in the middle of the Clinton administration.
Well, the Clinton administration inherited this policy from, George Herbert Walker Bush. Remember, the lethal finding was signed in October 92. There was a presidential election in November 92, which Bush lost. And Clinton came into power. And, immediately the Clinton administration has to deal with a number of issues. One, the day he was sworn in, the outgoing Bush administration had initiated major bombing campaigns against Iraqi military targets in the southern no-fly zone. So Clinton's coming in, assuming the presidency, with military action in place. Two, you have an alleged assassination attempt against George Herbert Walker Bush during a visit in Kuwait in the summer of 1993, which prompts Bill Clinton to fire cruise missiles against targets inside Baghdad, again, corrupting any chance that the Clinton administration might have had of tacking in an opposite direction away from regime change. The end result is the Clinton administration orders the CIA to continue the policy of regime change. The CIA creates a group called the Iraq National Congress. The head of it is Ahmed Chalabi, operating out of Kurdistan. They fail to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein routs these forces in combat. So in 95, Clinton, facing re-election in 96, orders the CIA to topple Saddam by the summer of 1996 to eliminate Saddam as a political problem at home. The CIA attempts to do so. They launch a coup d'etat in June 96. It fails. But my point being this, the Clinton administration not only inherited and sustained a policy of regime change, but they actually escalated that policy away from a passive policy towards an active policy where the CIA was actively targeting the Iraqi president and using the weapons inspection process as a vehicle to facilitate this targeting.
So what's going on there? Who was driving this? Madeleine Albright? Sandy Berger? Who?
Domestic politics. I mean, Sandy Berger, I think, is the driver. Remember, the national security advisor under the Clinton administration was more about domestic politics than he was about genuine national security.
So he's playing to the gallery.
We have to remember that in 1994, in the interim election, the Republicans staged the Great Revolution. Newt Gingrich and in the right wing of the Republican Party seized control of the United States Congress and start using Bill Clinton's inability to deal with complex foreign policy issues as a domestic foil to gain leverage on the domestic political front. And so now Clinton must be compelled to deal effectively with Saddam Hussein, and that's where the national security advisor steps in to shape policy that plays well to the domestic audience, regardless of its lack of substance when it comes to genuine national security.
So it's not an agenda of the neoconservatives. You can't argue that, really, if your
theory's
right.
You can't argue the genesis of it as being derived from neoconservative ideology, but what you can argue is that after 1996, with the CIA routed in Iraq, that the neoconservatives used Iraq as a vehicle to argue their larger policy objectives of global domination. And this is reflected by the 1997 vision statement by the Project for a New American Century, which turned into the language used in the 1998 Iraq Liberation Act, which became the platform of the Bush administration's run for a presidential election in 2000. Now it is the centerpiece of neoconservative ideology.
But just to return to the CIA, the thing I find really hard here is, they can hire the brightest and the best, and presumably they do. why, and just, you can't help thinking that the CIA is just an easy target here. I mean, if you're right, the CIA is a deeply incompetent organization, yet they must have some very bright people, people with very robust ideas. How come other secret services can actually provide independent, high-quality information the CIA can't, if you're right in your assessment?
Well, first of all, let's be careful. Let's look at other services first. You know, the Australian Intelligence Service will tell you that they didn't agree with the analysis put forward to sustain this war, that they will argue whether or not it could be shown that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. The British service today is going through a revisionist history of the same way. The CIA did not argue.
So they're all in the same box as far as you're concerned.
What we're talking about here is the politicization of intelligence. It's not that the CIA got it wrong. In fact, the deeper you dig into the CIA, the more you realize they got it right. They knew that Iraq had been fundamentally disarmed. But at a certain level in the CIA, the politics of implementing policy take over. So that the CIA had a task
of orders from above. Click in.
Absolutely.
So where does this leave you? You've been accused, I noticed in one blog, you've been accused of having an internet chat with a 14-year-old girl and were convicted of something or other in Albany.
I was never convicted of anything. And I had, it's an absurdity. It's a media, it didn't happen. I was arrested. Immediately, the judge dismissed the charges, recognizing the trumped-up nature of the accusation. Republicans stepped in and had the charges transferred to the federal government because they wouldn't accept the state finding. And 3 months ago, I got a call from the federal prosecutor who apologized and said that there's nothing here, that the federal government's declining to make any movement on this. But the purpose of all this is to smear the reputation of a man who's been 100% correct on the issue of Iraq, and it's politically inconvenient for me to be this correct.
Seymour Hersh, in the introduction to your book, says he thinks he knows what makes Scott Ritter tick. What does make Scott Ritter tick? Why are you doing all this? I mean, it's almost self-destructive how far you've gone, given that one example you've just given me.
Oh, but I've been accused of far worse. I've been accused of taking money from Saddam. I've been accused of spying. I've been accused of
serious felonies. What drives you on this one?
In 1984, I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic, when I joined the United States Marine Corps. I've gone to war for my country. I've put my life on the line for my country. What makes me tick? That oath makes me tick, because I took it seriously. If I'm willing to die for my country and die for what I believe in, you know how hard it is for me to speak? It's not hard at all. I'm speaking truth to power. And it's the most basic, most patriotic act an American can, undertake. And frankly speaking, there's no risk. You know, at the end of the day, I suffer no threat from those who seek to impugn my character when their charges are baseless. If they had any substance, I'd be afraid. Maybe I'd shut up. Maybe I wouldn't move forward. But I'm paying no price.
Scott Ritter, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Ritter's book, Iraq Confidential, is published in Australia by Palgrave Macmillan. And that's it for Late Night Live for tonight. On our next Canberra Babylon with Christian Kerr from Crikey, a discussion about cultural values and a look at the story of the Irish fascist, as he's called, Francis de Groot. You can stay on Radio National now for the news. I'll see you later.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.